Hello and welcome to Differential Discussions. I'm Melissa.
And I'm Dave.
And we're back today. We have George Fritzman with us again, and he's going to talk about part two of Have We Cured Hemophilia? So, the last session, he talked about the older ways that we had worked to treat hemophiliacs previously. And now he's going to talk about the newer, really cutting edge therapies that are available for our hemophiliacs. So, George, welcome back.
Thank you, Melissa and Dave. I'm glad to be back. And this is a slide we ended with last month. And we talked about the developments from 2003 to 2014, in which we had plenty of recombinant factor 8 and factor 9 that led to prophylaxis instead of on-demand therapy. And then we developed B domain deleted factor 8, with the hope to reduce the production of inhibitors. That didn't really work, but the B domain deleted factor 8s are now readily available. They create some problems in the lab because the standard one-stage clot-based assay doesn't really match the computed plasma levels. And so we've moved to the development of the chromogenic substrate, or CSA. What happened next? Well, what happened next is the production of extended half-life recombinant factor 8 B domain deleted concentrates. And this started with Sobi, and they had a double name, BioVerativ, with Eloctate and Adynovate, no, Eloctate and Alprolix, excuse me. That company developed Eloctate and Alprolix. Alprolix was a factor 9, and Eloctate was a factor 8. But they added an FC fragment to the molecule so that it would bind FC receptors, mostly on macrophages, and that would actually slow the metabolizing of the factor 8 organism. So factor 8 generally has about a 12-hour half-life, and they were able to extend it to almost 20 hours. And you say, well, big deal, 20 hours, what's the difference? Well, this meant that the boys need only infuse themselves once or twice a week instead of two or three times, which for these little boys, that was happy news. Factor 9 actually was able to be extended all the way to 86 hours, and in one case from CSL Behring, up to 104 hours. So this meant one infusion per week or even less. Now, besides the FC fragment, some of the other companies use pegylation, that's polyethylene glycol. That's used a lot in the production of drugs because the polyethylene glycol causes drugs to remain in the system a lot longer. Now, the pegylation did improve the length of time, but you're going to see, not by impressive amounts. So these are four of the factors that are available that have pegylation, and they extend the half-life shortly. Well, back in 20 or just a year ago in 2023, Sanofi developed and released Altuvio. Now, Altuvio uses both the FC fraction and also a von Willebrand factor fragment fusion to it. Now, the reason these half-lives are so short is, as you know, factor 8 circulates attached to von Willebrand factor. And so their half-life really depended on the von Willebrand factor half-life, which is also right around 12 hours. So by adding a von Willebrand factor fragment as well as the FC, they have managed to extend by up to 38 to 48 hours. And so this was an infusion that only had to be done about once a week. So again, the boys were happy to see that. And also this is true of these factor nines, three factor nine products that are quite lengthy. So a question of our this talk today is, have we cured hemophilia? No, this is not a cure. This is therapy only. And it creates an additional problem of how to measure these products. Remember, I told you last month that these are all B domain deleted, which means that the clot-based testing was not very accurate. And so it worked better to use chromogenic substrate testing. But now I'm going to show you the horrible slide. Here we are. So this slide is showing you about the various PTT reagents that may be used to measure the various concentrates. These are all of the factor eight concentrates. These are the factor nine concentrates. And if you have a green box, that means that works okay for measuring these. If it's yellow, not so good. If it's red, doesn't work well at all. I do not expect you to memorize this slide. However, I can tell you that it's available, an article by Dr. Annette Boyer from London and Bob Goslin from California together have put together a complete compendium of how well the various PTT products measure the various concentrates. And so some of these are the extended half-life concentrates. Some of them are the standard half-life concentrates. And this article is an open access article, so you can get it from your library very easily. Going on, these are the materials that can be assayed accurately by the chromogenic substrate assay. There are somewhat fewer methods available, but they are shown as well. Unfortunately, only two of these have been used to measure the factor nine concentrates, but several have been used for factor eight. So just if you're setting it up for your laboratory, then you can use Boyer and Gosselin's paper to show you which concentrates work the best. Now, there's more to the story. This is a description of using the clot-based versus the chromogenic substrate. Now, if you are just using these for diagnosis, they will usually match. When I say for diagnosis, this means this is the first time that you've tested a hemophilic and you're looking for native factor eight and factor nine. And they're going to match most of the time. But if they're discordant, and this, by the way, this is another article. Dr. Siddiqui Komami is a colleague of mine who works at Precision Biologic Incorporated. And this is not an open access article, so you have to request it from your library. But at any rate, they say if the two results are discordant, but both are within the reference interval or are in a therapeutic range, then you can establish the diagnosis. If one of them is within the reference interval, but the other falls into 10 to 40 units per deciliter, implying hemophilia, then you have to check the bleeding phenotype to see which one it coincides with. And if it is with the lower value, then then you can determine that is the bleeding phenotype. However, in the article, they give you the caveat that for a firm diagnosis, you really do need to follow up with genetic testing. And a lot of genetic testing for Factor 8 and Factor 9 products is coming online. And so that may be an important approach. Now, most of the time when you're measuring for Factor 8 or Factor 9, then you're actually measuring a concentrate, a therapeutic concentrate. And in that case, as I've shown you on the previous slides, there's a great deal of variability. And so the laboratory is in kind of a difficult spot here. The recommendations by the folks in this article are that you should use dedicated calibrators and controls, meaning, if you know that your particular institution is using a Dynavate or Eloctate, then you need to actually get calibrators and controls that match that product. Secondly, you've got to document your methodology and identify the reagents. If you notice from the slides that I just showed you, each of the PTT reagents has a slightly different activator and slightly different levels of phospholipid, and these will affect their results. Then you have to match and validate with the computed therapeutic concentrate. In other words, you can compute by dosage how much concentrate the patient should have gotten, and then try to match that with your clot-based or your chromogenic assay. Also, you got to check published data to document any correction factors that are around. One of the therapeutics actually has in its package insert instructions that say, just take the value that you get from our assay and double it, and that will then match the computed results. Now, that kind of advice causes medical lab scientists to lay awake at night. So I'm not necessarily recommending it, but that does appear in a package insert. You have to participate in the external quality assessments, such as that are offered by CAP. And then, above all, you've got to communicate the limitations with your hemophilia center. How well are you matching what are the computed values? So, as I say, most assays are used to follow the therapy, not to diagnose. You only diagnose once. You follow therapy month by month. So that's mostly what you're doing. Well, something new has come along in 2017. But going back to 1986, remember I said that we produced a factor VIII inhibitor bypassing activity that we named FEBA. And it's been available for on-demand therapy and even for prophylaxis. And the hospitals, the agencies that are providing factor like using FEBA because it's inexpensive compared to other products. Now, the problem with FEBA is that you can't give more than 200 units per kilogram per 24 hours, or it will cause DIC. And you can estimate it with the chromogenic substrate, but it isn't particularly accurate. Then, back in 1999, recombinant factor 7A or Novo7 was developed in Denmark and was approved for on-demand therapy and primarily for use in people who had factor 8 or factor 9 inhibitors. It does not cause a DIC risk, and you can assay it with the chromogenic substrate. You can't with the factor 8 clot base level. The factor 7 level assay can't really be. What I wanted to say is you can measure factor 8 level as a surrogate. You can't really measure the factor 7 level from Novo7 at all. Now, the downside of Novo7 is that it's quite expensive and it has a 6-hour half-life, so it has to be readministered every 6 to 12 hours. And there was some risk of it causing thrombosis. Since then, what was developed was emicizumab that was approved in 2017 for on-demand or prophylaxis, and it can be used for patients with or without inhibitors. It bypasses factor VIII altogether. This is now in industrialized countries, this has taken the place of the standard concentrate therapy. And so in industrialized companies, 70% of hemophilics now are treated with emicizumab. And the boys are happy because it's a once a month injection, not an infusion, but an injection. And the one risk, actually one during clinical trials, one patient died because they had attempted to combine it with either FIBA or factor seven, recombinant factor seven, and that caused a thrombotic event that actually was fatal. You can measure factor VIII. You may need to measure factor VIII once in a while when using emicizumab because occasionally the patients will have a breakthrough and need some factor VIII concentrate. And you can only measure it with the chromogenic substrate assay, and it has to use bovine reagents. Human reagents will interfere. Now, how does this stuff work? Well, you knew sooner or later you'd see the dreaded coag mechanism, and here it is. And here is factor VIII, which works with factor nine to combine 10 and 5, which then act upon prothrombin to give you thrombin. But if the factor VIII is either absent or if there's an inhibitor, then you can actually use Hemlibra to bypass the need for factor VIII altogether. And this shows the mechanism. Here's the normal way that factor VIII combines 9 and 10. It just forms a complex and it combines those and activates factor 10. Emicizumab takes the place of factor VIII and it accomplishes the same thing. This is what's called a bispecific antibody. It works on the basis of an antibody attraction to the two molecules. And it sounds brilliant. It took Roche 40,000 tries to get something that worked. And so they've got that now. And there's a competitor that's working on a new, more effective form that's called MIM-8 that I won't go into any more detail on, but that will probably become available in a year or two. Emicizumab has been so effective and has changed therapy so much that the boys no longer have to come to the hemophilia clinic at all. And the National Hemophilia Foundation has renamed itself the National Bleeding Disorders, the National Bleeding Disorders Foundation, because they really don't have much to do in providing products for hemophilics because of the use of Hemlibra. Along with that, in 2022, CSL Behring developed a gene transfer. And I put the word cure here because this really is a cure. And they use this is a standard approach to transferring genes. They use an adeno-associated virus. This is a safe virus. It doesn't become infectious. And it's a liver tropism vector that causes the DNA that's being transferred to develop within hepatocytes. Now, the virus does cause a transient form of hepatitis and needs to be treated with prednisolone. And all the patients show some liver enzyme elevations. And it was confined to people who are currently using factor nine prophylaxis therapy and have current or past life-threatening hemorrhage or repeated major spontaneous bleeds. This is an interesting molecule. The factor nine that is used in this is called factor nine Padua, named after a town in Italy. And the factor nine Padua actually has 10 times the activity of normal or wild type factor nine. And so it produces no inhibitors. And the study that caused the FDA to clear this in 2022 showed with seven subjects that the levels of factor nine rose very well and have remained stable for up to 6 years so far. The cost of this is a single treatment, and the cost of the single treatment is a staggering $2.5 million. However, they make the point that the patient over a lifetime is going to consume about $20 million worth of products. Now, factor eight was a little harder to develop because it's a bigger molecule, but Roctavian has made a factor eight gene transfer, and that was approved in 2023. And so this is now a B domain deleted factor eight, and they use that same vector, recombinant adeno-associated virus, but it's modified to be able to handle the large factor eight molecule. And a clinical trial on 134 hemoglobin hemophilia A patients showed that it maintained a factor eight activity level at 1 year of about 42 international units per deciliter. The annual bleed rate declined by 98.6%, and factor eight concentrate usage is said to have declined by 83.8%. But indeed, there should be no necessity for the use of factor eight. There are also no inhibitors. There is this problem of the liver function tests becoming elevated for a period of time and needing to be treated. And the factor nine therapy, currently the RAC rate is 2.9 million, and they estimate that the current lifetime therapeutic cost for these boys and men is $25 million. Post-market, they've shown some factor eight level declines, and it tends to stabilize at around 5 to 20 units per deciliter at after 3 years. This is not so good because if it stabilizes at about five, it's ineffective. And so several of the providers are now working on synthesizing a form of gain of function factor eight. It'll be some years before those are developed. There's probably a dozen different approaches to finding a gain of function factor eight to be used as a gene transfer, one of which is to add some it was canine fragments to the factor eight molecule. Now, there's some considerations about gene transfer that has probably slowed the adoption. For one thing, patients tend to resist the idea of a genetic transfer. They imagine that it might cause mutagenesis, maybe cause cancer later on. They worry about that adeno-associated virus and the effect on liver. It can't be discontinued. Once you start the treatment, you're in for the whole thing. And if you are being treated with these steroids for a fairly long period of time, they tend to mask inflammation markers, and so you may fail to notice that you have some inflammatory response. The patients are quote, emboldened, and then we'll try more rigorous activities that can cause some joint deterioration. However, even though there's no further need for prophylaxis, it does appear that you may still need to treat occasional bleeds, so it's not a complete cure. Long-term monitoring is required, and again, our monitoring techniques, either the clot-based or the chromogenic substrate, both for hemophilia A and hemophilia B, are unreliable. Why is that? You would think if you're making your own 8 or 9, that it should go back to the way it was at the beginning. But the truth is that the liver is producing the 8 or 9 in different cells in the hepatocytes and not the Kupffer cells. And so it is actually a slightly different factor 8 or factor 9. Now, on hemophilia A, over 6 years per clinical trial, it seemed to be stable, but does in decline, as I mentioned, post-market therapy. For hemophilia B, factor 9, it does remain steady, and so that has been more successful. So it is available. We can think of gene transfer as a cure, but there are other approaches that are also being used. And one, the really interesting one, is called rebalancing therapy. With rebalancing therapy, you are suppressing one of the control proteins, one of the CoA control proteins, to balance it off against the lack of factor 8 or factor 9. The two proteins are either tissue factor pathway inhibitor or antithrombin. And just in December of 2024, just 1 month before I've recorded this presentation, monoclonal antibodies that suppress TFPI translate that suppress the production of TFPI were FDA approved. One is called concizumab, or Alhemo, produced by Novo Nordisk, requires a daily injection. The other is marstacimab, Hepvazi. It's by Pfizer. I guess they ran out of good names. And this works on a weekly injection. And both will be shipped February 2025, probably about the time that this presentation is released. They have not published the charges. We don't know what it's going to cost. Meanwhile, Sanofi is working on fitusiran. This is a different mechanism. This is something called synthetic interfering small RNA molecules that complement an mRNA sequence. And this concept was first developed by Napoli in 1990. He used it to produce specialized petunias. And all this is doing is it's suppressing the production, the translation, I should say, of the normally produce messenger RNA. And fitusiran then will suppress the antithrombin messenger RNA. Antithrombin levels will be down, and this is going to be approved. Well, they anticipate it will be approved by March of 2025. Because you're rebalancing and suppressing the control factors, there is absolutely no need to measure factor 8 or factor 9. And I should say, by the way, these mechanisms work for both hemophilia A or hemophilia B. And you'll have no reason to want to assay the factor 8 or factor 9, but we're going to have to ramp up our monitoring of TFPI or antithrombin, because we will probably need to monitor those. Now, how does this work? Again, in the coag mechanism, this time we've got a picture of TFPI, which suppresses the level of factor 7 and factor 10. It's called tissue factor pathway inhibitor, and it is suppressed by concizumab or marstacimab monoclonal antibodies. And fitusiran, on the other hand, can suppress antithrombin production, and that's an RNA. So these are taking advantage of what is called the Goldilocks principle. Goldilocks, the old nursery rhyme, in which the porridge is either too hot, too cold, or just right. The Goldilocks principle says if you've got too little of your coag factors, you will have bleeding. If you have too little of your control factors, you will have clotting. But if you can balance them just right, then you will have normal coagulation. So this methodology has gone through a lot of phase two and phase three trials, and it really does appear to work. And so this may be one of the answers to therapy. It's not a cure, but it's easily administered and easily managed and monitored. So we have now both the extended half-life factors that are available, as well as the old standard half-life factors for prophylaxis or even for on-demand therapy. We then have the cures for factor 9 and factor 8. We have bypassing therapy, emicizumab, and now we also have rebalancing therapy. So lots of new approaches to managing hemophilia. You know, the rate of hemophilia is about 1 in 5,000 live male births. And while it is inherited, the rate of spontaneous mutation is about 33%. And so in many cases, a boy can be born with hemophilia, though there's no evidence of it in the immediate relatives. So this really does become a very important approach to therapy. So thanks for listening. And do you have any questions?
I think it's interesting with the gene transfer for factor 8. Mm-hmm. That goes to the liver.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about endogenous factor 8, it's really not synthesized there. It's really synthesized in endothelial cells. So you'd think that they would want to make the gene transfer go to endothelial cells.
Which is not, well, I don't know that there's any kind of a vector that will work for endothelial cells, partly mm-hmm. because they're all over your body.
Yeah.
So, and in fact, they are being produced. The Kupffer cells really are they're not really endothelial cells, but they're part of the reticular endothelial system. And they're actually what are producing the factor 8 in the liver. So, yeah, they're just taking advantage of the fact that this vector will introduce these slices of DNA into hepatocytes.
I wonder if that's part of the problem, is that it's not in the correct location for factor 8 too.
Exactly.
It's also interesting to see that when introduction of that vector occurs, that there are LFTs elevated, suggesting liver cell death. And while the virus itself is non-pathological, it still appears to be causing some sort of damage, right?
It is transient, and in nearly all cases it goes away after a few weeks or months.
Interesting. I find it also fascinating. Like, I always think about in this space where we have pharmaceutical companies, health insurance companies, speaking from the United States perspective. And it's fascinating to see where financial incentives align. So seeing how the cost of treatment for a hemophiliac is this much and how a gene therapy can be this much, I think that that's interesting thing to look at from a business and more macroeconomic kind of scale as to how it affects stuff. I find that curious. There's always this prevailing sort of wisdom, or I shouldn't say wisdom, this prevailing sentiment from the public that most pharmacological interventions aren't seeking to cure, that they're seeking to treat over time. And this would sort of fly in the face of that particular sentiment in a sense, but
I can't really comment on,
sure.
various tricks that we use, but there is this generalized idea that we don't really like to create vaccines because they cure and then we can't make any more money. I don't know how much of that is true.
Right. And that's where I find this to be sort of interesting, sort of data point there. Yeah, super cool. I also am very interested in the TFPI suppression. So when I teach COAG, and so much of what I do teach can be a bit black and white. And when I talk about COAG, I really try to get this image by the end of all of it, right? That you have all of these pro-coagulants and anti-coagulants and them kind of fighting each other in a sense, right? For lack of a better word.
Right.
And that in they come to a homeostasis, right? This push and pull in the middle. And what a curious way to think about the problem to move that balance in like a direction. Because it's so intuitive to say, hey, I'm missing a factor. Let me
Yeah.
put that factor in you. And how I never ever thought, and it's why I'm poor, to just take away the other piece and to move the balance.
Yeah, you ever have that thought? Why didn't I think of that? It seems easy.
what a beautiful sort of thought and solution to an old problem. Very old problem, you know. That's cool. I did not know that existed, genuinely. That was really cool.
Well, and I'm kind of amazed that, I lectured on this material last October up in Portland. And I mentioned phytoceran, but I didn't even mention the anti-TFPIs. And here, they not only are they available, but not only were they doing this, but they've actually been made available in December. Apparently, the FDA figures are safe and effective.
I do. I would love to see over time, right, as we, collect more data and learn more, because there's still, I wonder about situations to where the hemostatic environment is challenged significantly. What sort of challenges you might run into with decreasing those proteins and those.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. The phytoceran study back in phase, they started on phytoceran maybe 5 years or 6 years ago, and the phase two study actually caused a fatality in someone who had a thrombotic disorder. And so you have to think, well, it is possible for a hemophilic to also have a thrombotic disorder, which creates, a knife edge balance.
Right. Yeah, it would seem that you really need to be looking at all the different variables. And when you consider anticoagulants, procoagulants, there's a lot of pieces in that puzzle. Still very, very cool. That's awesome.
Well, and that patient that you're just talking about, where a patient who has hemophilia and a clotting disorder, that really highlights, because we talk to our students and we always say, we in school, we give you the straightforward, like, this case study is a hemophilia, this patient has this, but how often do patients have multiple things wrong with them? And it's really hard to care for them because they have so many things. And that patient really highlights it, because you think hemophiliac, oh, it's bleeding, but what if they have a concurrent thrombotic disorder? That is really challenging.
I don't usually lecture this much anymore because we don't do much of it, but It used to be back at UAB many years ago, if we had a hemophilic come in, well, they would just reconstitute four or five vials and go ahead and infuse them all, with the idea that, let's get this bleeding stopped and take care of it. And I worked with Dr. Marissa Marcus, and she insisted that they compute just about how much they need. If you can find out how much factor eight they've got to start with, well, if it's midnight, you're not going to find that out because you'd have to run the assay, and they don't usually do that in the night shift. So then you might say, well, we can use zero as the value, and then figure out by the person's weight and their hematocrit how much you have to use. And that there is a risk of thrombosis if you overuse, not to mention by starting making people do the formula, she saved the hospital about 400,000 a year. So.
And I imagine too, it might even have an influence on things like generating antibodies to products and things like that. And but yeah, it is curious that someone can have a hemorrhagic disease and a thrombotic disorder that is not observed, right? Because of the hemorrhagic disease.
It could go completely
Oh,
diagnosed.
yeah, that's fascinating. That was really cool. I learned a lot.
My only other comment is that with excuse me, the gene therapy for factor eight, who's gonna want to pay 2.9 million if the factor eight isn't gonna be stable?
And that's where I don't like to talk about financial incentives because it's kind of icky in the space that we're in, right? But it's certainly consideration, isn't it?
I think that people also concern themselves with the risk of mutagenesis, which doesn't appear to be a risk in all the phase two trials that they've done. But if you said, well, okay, we're going to do this, but you may still have to get some factor from time to time, I'd say, well, thanks, let's try something else.
Right.
And
Just give me the
that,
emicizumab.
yeah, we'll go with that. Now, I think the idea of finding, a gain of function factor eight is well underway, and that may resolve the issue. But, the trouble with factor eight is it's such a big molecule, it does tend to deteriorate, and it does have to circulate with von Willebrand factor. So those are the weaknesses. They don't affect factor nine. It's a smaller molecule, and it doesn't have to, attach itself to a carrier molecule. So that's been more successful.
Space to be in, and a cool time in our history to see be developing in real time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the other thing is that the companies that make the assays, our business, in vitro diagnostics, really looking for something that can be universally reliable.
Sure.
And
But there's so many moving pieces, though. Oof.
that's the problem. And so that's why I love to show those slides that Gosselin produced. Those, I mean, he and Boyer worked hard to look at all of those reagents and line them up and see which ones worked. And it's helpful because that's all we've got right now to work with. But I'm sure that a person at a place like Precision or George King or Stago, they're looking to find something that can be universal.
Certainly a difficult problem. And it's funny to think that the assay development might be a tougher nut to crack than the actual therapy and intervention.
Could be.
That's interesting.
Well, I think the other part that's hard about it is that the people who are creating the interventions don't think about laboratory testing and monitoring it at all. So it's sort of an after the fact problem that we have to think about.
It's going to be certainly low on the scale. Like I'm sure they do sort of consider it, but yeah, it's like if the therapy works, they're like, who cares, right?
I had an experience like that. The direct oral anticoagulants, the DOACs, that really started being released around 2009. The first one was the anti-thrombin DOAC, and I was at a presentation in which the principal investigators were talking about the studies that they did and how well it was working and how many bleeding risks there were. And I raised my hand and I said, how do we monitor these things? And apparently I must have said the wrong thing because the room got real quiet. And they had, now they were using like an instrumental approach, using like an electrophoretic approach or something like that to measure the product. But how I was asking, what's a good clinical test? I mean, we do protimes for Coumadin, so what would we do for DOACs? And the answer is we don't. And we
Set up
still,
a gel, I guess.
yeah, right. And we actually still don't have an approved method for measuring DOACs.
The therapy is moving much faster than the diagnostic side, which is actually funny to think about. So, like I said, as a harder nut to crack, I wonder. I wonder if that's just like. It really is sort of an afterthought. Is the laboratory always an afterthought in these things?
Feels that way sometimes, doesn't it?
Yikes.
Yeah.
I will also say what a good problem to have when you consider in my lifetime, I was born in 84, how much the landscape has changed in hemophiliac intervention.
Yes.
So it's pretty cool. It's a little scary too how fast these things kind of go, but
Yeah, I think it's fascinating to think that in my lifetime, it was 1966 when cryo was developed. And do you still dispense some cryo now and then?
so that would the job of the blood bank. I think certainly they do, but it's usually for fibrinogen. If I, it's been a while since I studied for the board, George. But I think predominantly for just kind of reestablishing fibrinogen levels and generally,
Doing
and
it.
maybe as a balancing factor for like, I there's probably a blood banker somewhere that's watching this that's cringing. But I would imagine a certain amount of cryo for, plasma units and things like that.
But yeah, we were making cryo. All we knew was that we were making anti-hemophilic factor. It had only recently been named eight, and we still didn't have a name for von Willebrand factor in 1960. Was 68 when I was doing that, and we didn't know that. Soon we figured out fibrinogen was there and von Willebrand factor, but not when I was doing it in 68.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, geez, do I have anything else?
No, we have
That
nothing else.
was cool. It was just it
Yeah,
was yeah, it was really neat.
that was awesome. George, thank you so much. We really appreciate your knowledge and your insight.
Well, thanks. This is fun. I've enjoyed doing this. So, anyway, I hope to see you again at a meeting soon.
Absolutely. And everybody else, thanks for watching.
Thanks for your time.